Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Oakland County child killings. Before we get into the case this week, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. You can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, along with exclusive content such as the Vince McMahon story, the Columbine Massacre, and our current relook at the Atlanta child murders. And if you act right now up until the end of December, you can get 50% off of your first month's subscription. I'd like to point out that all of the tiers allow you access to this content that I put out on the Patreon channel, the exclusive shows, the early access shows. The difference is that as you go up in tiers, you get little perks, such as the most popular tier, the $5 tier, where you get exclusive stickers mailed to your house after, I believe it's 3 months, and that is going to be expanded here shortly as I'm working on more designs. With that said, I have to give a shout out to my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, and also my two biggest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie from True Crime University and Samantha. All of you guys are amazing, and I appreciate you greatly. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go in the crypt. When we left off last week, we had been discussing a newspaper article that came out concerning three men who had been arrested for child sexual abuse. The two most important of those three are Greg Green and Chris Bush. And while we are going to be getting heavily into the two of them this week, before we get to that, I want to discuss the last of the murders that were officially tied to the Oakland County child killer, that being the abduction and murder of Timothy King. So there are various different dates given for Timothy King's abduction. I've seen March 17th, I've seen March 16th, and that seems to be the consensus from his family is March 16th, 1977, in Birmingham, Michigan, which is to the north of downtown Detroit. 11-year-old Timothy King went to the Hunter Maple Pharmacy 4 blocks from his home. It's stated around 8:30 that evening, he left the pharmacy through a back door and was not seen again. An intensive search was conducted for Timothy King, with his parents going on the local news, pleading with him to come home, his mother saying that if he came home, she would make him his favorite meal of fried chicken. Some tips came in while Timothy was missing, all of them concerned seeing Tim in the parking lot talking to men. One stated that he was seen talking to a man beside a blue AMC Gremlin with a white racing stripe on the side. And this car is going to be the one that's really going to dominate the minds of the public, as a Gremlin was seen when Mark Stebbins was abducted. However, another individual, a car designer, came forward and stated that they had seen Timothy talking to two men, one younger, the other in his 50s, beside a 1973 Oldsmobile Cutlass, which was parked at the rear of the store. However, it should be noted that this car designer underwent hypnosis in 2012, and he recalled that the car was in fact a 73 Pontiac Le Mans, which is very similar in appearance. He also recalled the last five digits of the license plate number were 222. Let's say, hypothetically, a perpetrator were be able to be tracked down and tied to this car. Unfortunately, because hypnotism is seen as a pseudoscience, this car designer's testimony would be inadmissible in court, as because it's a pseudoscience, he would not be allowed to give testimony, as his hypnosis session taints his testimony. It should be noted, though, that it is highly unlikely that unless a perpetrator is discovered through other means, that this car will ever be found, as these crimes happened so long ago, there is very, very little chance of them ever finding any record of it, because DMVs don't keep records from that far back. Which is a shame, because there might be an opportunity to track down a Le Mans with that license plate number if they still had access to those records. To the best of our knowledge, they do not exist, though. On March 18th, the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office authorizes all police officers operating in Oakland County to stop and search any vehicle seen driving on the streets of Oakland County after midnight. And this should give you some idea of just how heightened everyone's awareness was of these abductions and murders, that the prosecutor felt safe in issuing this order. And it's very possible that this may have, you know, prevented further abductions or things of that nature. Part of me wonders, however, if they might not have been able to narrow the search down. We've got the Le Mans as well as this Gremlin, and if they had just put out a blanket all points bulletin giving the officers authorization to stop any of those vehicles that match the description of the cars in question at any point that they are seen, if that might not have turned up viable suspects and or Timothy King. Unfortunately, though, as you're going to see, many people involved in this case believe that there was a cover-up of some sort. On March 22nd, 1977, Timothy King's body was discovered at 11:45 p.m. lying in a ditch on Gill Road. Two men were driving along Gill Road in Livonia, which is actually the next county over, Wayne County, when they spotted the boy's body with his skateboard lying a few feet away. On autopsy, he was found to have died from asphyxiation. There were abrasions inside of his mouth indicative of forced oral sex, as well as tearing and dilation of his anal cavity, meaning that Timothy King had been sexually assaulted on numerous occasions prior to the discovery of his body. There was also a bite mark discovered on his tongue. It is a little descriptive, but thought to have been inflicted by Timothy King himself as he bit down in pain from the savageness of the assaults that he was being subjected to. And again, the authorities did not release any of this information concerning the sexual assaults for reasons that have never fully been revealed. The one thing they did put out is that Timothy King was found with fried chicken inside of his stomach, meaning that the abductor or abductors had heard his parents' pleas on the news and fixed him or purchased him a meal of fried chicken prior to murdering him. Now, the manner of these murders, how these children were asphyxiated, has always been thought to be that a hand was placed over both the children's nose to pinch it and over their mouths, basically forcing them to suffocate in that manner. And all of this has unfortunately given these crimes a much nicer moniker than they really deserve, and that is of the babysitter murders. And the police helped foster this idea by stating untrue things such as the children had been well taken care of and bathed, and their clothing had been cleaned, and their hair had been combed, their fingernails clipped, that sort of thing. From everything that I could find in police records, which are available online, as well as other researchers' notes, none of these things appear to have been true, with the exception of the fact that the children's clothing had been laundered at some point. Basically, what that means is these people weren't taking care of these kids. They were doing everything that they possibly could do to try and eliminate evidence that might link them to these murders. These children's well-being was of no importance to them. Staying out of law enforcement's radar was the only thing that mattered, other than physically abusing these children and hiding their culpability. About a year and a half later, the task force is officially closed down. On December 15th, 1978, citing lack of resources, leads, etc. And in the next few years after the task force is shut down, former members began spinning the theory that the perpetrator may have been placed into a mental institution for other crimes, or been incarcerated or dead, meaning that it would be an unsolvable crime. Now, before we get into all of the nitty-gritty of the various suspects and the pedophile rings that are thought by many to have been responsible with good reason, I do want to cast a couple of glances at the murdered young girls. As I've discussed in other series covering similar cases, it is extremely, extremely rare for perpetrators to change their MO so drastically, meaning to go from one target victim type, in this case young boys, to another target victim type, these young girls. Now, it is rare, but it is not unheard of. There are those out there whose enjoyment is simply in the abuse of children. More often than not, though, in these cases, the individuals are producing child pornography for commercial release, meaning for other pedophiles to purchase and view and gain enjoyment from. And which point they target both boys and girls. This case is different, however, as to the best of our knowledge, the girls were not sexually assaulted in any fashion. That's not to say that they may not have been, and the police have just never released documents stating that, but we have no evidence to indicate that that is the case. So what does that leave us with? It could be that the girls were taken and photographed in the nude for sale to other individuals of a like-minded disposition, i.e. a pedophile. Or it could be that both of these girls were mistakenly taken, as the abductor believed them to be boys. Now, I'm not casting aspersions on either of these girls and calling them manly. I'm trying to point out the fact that during this period of time, it was not uncommon for boys of this age range to have long, shaggy hair. And it would be very easy for an individual to encounter these girls, mistake them for a boy, grab them, and then later on realize their mistake, and rather than release them, at which point the kidnappers could be identified, they held them for a period of time and then murdered them, disposing of their bodies in a manner similar to that of the boys. Now, that's just a theory on my part based on, you know, the knowledge or lack of knowledge that we have, i.e., there is no indications of sexual abuse present in either of the girls' cases. However, there is plenty of evidence present to indicate sexual abuse in the case of the boys. So it is possible that this happened, or, again, that they were taken simply so that photographs and maybe videos of them could be produced where no intercourse was performed, and then they were killed afterwards. That, too, is a possibility. Till we have the actual perpetrator of these crimes, or perpetrators, we will unfortunately never know. We're going to turn our attention at this point to the list of suspects. And I'm going to attempt over the course of this episode and the next episode to paint a portrait of Detroit and its surrounding environs that is in stark contrast to what most people see or think of when the word Detroit is mentioned. Because during this period of time, Detroit had a serious child sex ring problem. Now, what is a child sex ring? It is when two or more individuals engage in the sexual exploitation of children for their own personal and or financial gain. What does that mean? It means two or more individuals target multiple victims over a period of time, sexually abusing them either on their own, together, or sharing them with other individuals, taking photographs, videos, and selling or giving those to other pedophiles for their own enjoyment. That is a child sex abuse ring. You have heard me talk over the past 4 years, starting really with the Dean Corll case, the Houston mass murders, when I started this show, of North Fox Island and Francis D. Sheldon. Now, since the time that I did that show, and I was one of the first shows to mention Sheldon and North Fox Island, a whole lot of research has been done on Francis Sheldon. And that research shows that he and his activities are interwoven with the activities of many other men who are suspected of possibly or are believed in the eyes of some members of law enforcement to have been responsible for the Oakland County child killings. And while there are other cases of children dying around this period of time and of abductions, we're going to cover those at the tail end of this series, as based on what I've seen, I don't believe any of them are linked to these crimes, especially with the information that we have concerning when these killings, which were linked together by law enforcement, stopped. The first two suspects we're going to look at are probably two of the most well-known suspects in the Oakland County child killings, that being Gregory Green and Christopher Bush. I have to warn you before we discuss these suspects that the information you are going to hear may be extremely disturbing to some listeners, as these two pieces of shit were beyond abhorrent, and in my view, both of them met ends that were too good for them. Gregory Green grew up in Flint, Michigan, attending a parochial school. From all indications, he had a normal childhood, the exception of his mother dying during his junior year. However, Green did end up graduating from high school, while his father worked at one of the many, many auto plants in the industry. According to Green, when he was growing up, he was taught right and wrong. However, he did admit to the police that his brother also had a quote-unquote sex problem. Gregory Green was a clean-shaven, dark-haired individual. His hair was kind of longer. And in fact, in mugshot photos of him, he looks like a complete dirtbag. He does bear a striking resemblance to composite sketches compiled from possible witnesses. And as you're going to see, he has a modus operandi very similar to that which was perpetrated in the Oakland County child killings. In the early 1970s, Gregory Green leaves Flint, Michigan for California, specifically the Huntington Beach, Los Angeles area, where he starts coaching a youth little league team comprised of young boys aged 6 to 14. Green was said to be a very aggressive sexual predator, beating the boys, threatening to kill them, choke them, that type of thing, as he sexually assaulted them, basically coercing them with gifts, violence, threats of violence, threats against their families. On August 2nd, 1974, Gregory Woodward Green is arrested by the Huntington County Sheriff's Department on multiple counts of child sexual abuse, kidnapping, and attempted murder. Under interrogation, Green admits to molesting 15 male victims over 200 times throughout the preceding years. In a summary report released in the summer of 2008, a detective by the name of Corey Williams states, Green arrested in Huntington Beach, California for 45 counts of CSC1 on young boys, then spent 6 months in the Orange County Jail. Green choked two of his victims, one almost to death, to keep him quiet after attempting to anally molest the boy. Green then drove him to the area of the hospital and dumped him off on the grass. Green thought he had killed this boy and dragged his body through the grass to his car after burning him with cigarettes in an attempt to get the boy to wake up. The boy survived. That's how Green got caught. Detectives ask Green if he ever had relations or ever thought of having relations with a woman. Green replied that he had tried and thought about it, but he can't get a hard-on with a woman. So basically, one of the victims, Green, chokes this boy almost to death. Tries to wake him up by burning him with cigarettes. When he will not wake up, Green drives to a hospital and dumps the boy on the grass outside, drives away, and then calls the hospital to tell them the boy is outside. This leads to Green being arrested and sentenced on January 31st, 1975, to the Patton State Mental Hospital in San Bernardino. It's said that Green made attempts to learn more about himself, why he was the way he was, and why he was attracted to young boys during his confinement to this mental hospital. It was also said that he was assertive during his therapy sessions and took a leadership role that impressed staff members. Now, with Green in captivity, we're going to switch our view back to the Detroit area, where we're going to look at the man many suspect of being Gregory Green's accomplice, Christopher Brian Bush. He's 5'8", 250-pound bearded man who came from a very wealthy family. His father being the director of financial affairs for GM in Europe and America. There aren't many pictures of Christopher Bush online, but everyone that you find depicts just a miserable-looking human being. Christopher had a life of excess, leisure, call it what you want. His family was exceedingly wealthy. He went to schools overseas, exclusive schools that other extremely wealthy families sent their sons to, was the manager of a restaurant that presumably his parents owned, and at the time that we're talking, the early to mid-1970s, he's in his 20s, he's living at home in his parents' house, and basically doing whatever the hell he wants. Anything you find on Christopher Bush starts off with, he was a known pedophile, committed numerous sex acts, his father's wealth kept him out of trouble. We don't have, however, is a clear picture of when Bush started offending. We can only assume that he learned the tricks of his trade, as it were, through others within the circles that Bush traveled in, that is the very wealthy. We do know that there was a pretty extensive ring of pedophiles active in this area during this period of time, and it's very possible that Bush may have been a victim of one of these obscenely wealthy pedophiles. And as you're going to see, we do know that he had ties to numerous pedophiles, one of which was just as wealthy, or so it seems, as Bush's father was. Now, there are stories out there, too, that Bush's father may have had similar predilections as his son, i.e., an interest in young boys. However, I do want to point out, in case you do your own research on this, this is not verified. These are only rumors and innuendo, speculation from people trying to figure out why Bush's family would cover for him so extensively. My point of view on it's a little bit different, having come from an area where the vast majority of the families are obscenely wealthy and well-to-do. More often than not, it's not that the patriarch of the family is engaged in similar crimes so much as it is that the family thinks very little of those who are financially beneath them, and they do not want anything that their offspring might do to bring shame or scandal to the family name. When I'm talking about this, that I come from a different type of background than many, The Forbes family is from the general area in New Jersey that I'm from. They're buried in the same cemeteries as family members of mine. The DeLoreans, the DuPonts, the list goes on and on and on of individuals who had obsessive amounts of wealth and could basically get away with anything. And it, more often than not, it boiled down to the family not wanting their name dragged through the mud in the local or in the national press. And that's more likely than not what we have here, based on the facts that we have. So let's look at what we know about Christopher Brian Bush. What we do know about Bush's earliest crimes is that prior to 1976, he had been sexually assaulting boys in and around the Detroit area on a pretty consistent basis, and many of the areas that he haunted were areas where future Oakland County child killing victims would be picked up from. Basically, Bush would get these children in his car, drive them to a secluded area, sexually assault them, and then dump them out somewhere else. Don't have a lot of information on these children's names because obviously they were minors when this happened. The courts weren't going to publish their names, and the majority of them have not come forward, which is understandable given what we know about the crimes that Bush committed, which have come to light. See, his family owned a cabin up by S or Essa Lake, which is 4 hours north of Detroit, that he would bring victims to where he would sexually assault them in seclusion where no one could hear the boys crying, and he could get away with doing whatever he wanted. We do know that January 1st, 1976, Christopher Bush purchases a blue Vega, and some have speculated that this Vega may in fact be the mysterious gremlin that the police had the public keeping an eye on. Somewhere in all of this, Christopher Bush encounters a young boy by the name of James Vincent Vince Gunnels and begins grooming this boy before escalating this to sexual assault. We know that Bush raped this boy on at least two occasions, the first of which was January 30th of 1976 at the family cabin. We know that there's at least one other instance of Bush sexually assaulting Gunnels, which is eventually going to lead to Gunnels' father pressing charges against Bush. It's highly unlikely that Bush's assaults on Gunnels only occurred twice. It's much, much more likely that he repeatedly sexually assaulted this boy, and that the dates he was charged with having done it are the two that stood out most to this unfortunate child. And Bush ends up leaving for England for a 3-week vacation, so far as we know, shortly after sexually assaulting Gunnels. The real purpose of this trip, however, is unknown. What we know about Bush that I'm going to get into, it's more likely than not that he was well established inside of this pedophile network by this point, and it could very well be that one of his friends within this network put him in contact with pedophiles over in Britain, and that he had traveled over there to partake of the abuse of British boys. I know that may sound a little outlandish and conspiracy theory-ish, but these things do, in fact, happen. If you listen to the 14-part series I did on Jimmy Savile, the disgraced British media personality, there were many allegations that Savile partook in this type of activity traveling great distances across Britain, possibly into other countries, to participate in the assault of children. There are also statements from Britain's most infamous pedophile, Sidney Cook, that there were flophouses, for lack of a better term, throughout Great Britain, where individuals such as he and those members of his gang could just show up, abuse a boy, and then be on their way again. And that these locations would be visited not only by Englishmen, but also by foreigners who came to Britain for, you know, a holiday or whatever, or to simply partake in the abuse of children. Back in California, Gregory Green is released from the mental hospital on January 15th, 1976, at which point he's transferred to the Huntington Beach County Jail, where he remains until February 11th, 1976, at which point he is put on probation and allowed to return to Michigan. We know Christopher Bush returned from England on February 14th, 1976, and at some point in all of this, Bush and Green meet. There are different stories on how this happens. One set of police notes states that Bush was molesting his nephew who lived in Flint and met Green during the course of this molestation. However, another researcher postulates that Bush and Green may have, in fact, met during Green's confinement to the mental hospital. Apparently, he was let out during some period of time during his incarceration and, in fact, returned to Michigan briefly before going back to California and the hospital. And while he was in Michigan during this point in time, his family got him a number of psychology and self-help books. It's also possible, however, that the two of them met sometime prior to the start of their criminal partnership, possibly in the early 1970s, during the time that Green was bouncing back and forth between California and Michigan. We have no records, really, of Bush's travels. For all we know, Bush may have traveled to California in the Huntington Beach area on a number of occasions and encountered Green. Again, we simply don't have this information. If there are any criminal records concerning the two of them prior to their 18th birthdays, they've either been lost, destroyed, or are under lock and key. Whatever the case may be, in terms of how these two scumbags met, right after Chris Bush returns from England, Mark Stebbins goes missing and then is found murdered, having been sexually assaulted and suffocated. My only qualm with the Green and Bush line of suspects is, from what we know of Green, who is said to be the more aggressive, violent of the two offenders, is that from what we know of Gregory Green, he didn't smother his victims. He throttled them, choking them with his hands. And from everything we know of the OCCK crimes, the victims were not throttled, but were instead smothered. And I bring that up because oftentimes when you have violence offenders like this, the way that they kill a victim escalates rather than de-escalates. And at least to me, unless Christopher Bush or somebody else within this ring that these two men end up becoming a part of committed the actual murders, it's highly unlikely that Gregory Green is going to go from a violent throttling to smothering the victims with his hands. That's a downgrade in manner of assault, even though the victim ends up dying. Back to our timeline, March 1st, 1976, Gregory Green meets with his new probation officer. Well, on the 29th of March, Gregory Green begins outpatient therapy. On May 7th of 1976, Christopher Bush invites Vince Gunnels to the family's home in Sanford, Michigan, which is in Midland County, to ride dirt bikes. And according to Gunnels, during this trip, Bush attempted to tie him up and anally rape him. However, Gunnels is able to escape and flees Bush. However, his association with Bush will not end there, as you're going to see. Gregory Green ends up taking a job working at a local Kmart as a custodial supervisor, from which he will be fired at the end of December 1976. He's also said to be coaching Little League again, which, given his prior history, at least my opinion, should have raised some eyebrows with his probation officers as well as his counselors, but they don't seem to have been overtly concerned with Green being involved in activities involving young boys. According to a man by the name of Kenneth Bowman, on May 29th, 1976, Bush and Green picked him up in Bush's Green Vega. Bowman was 13 years old at this point in time and stated that he was driven to a wooded area off of Dixie Highway in Groveland Township. Bowman told investigators later that he feared he would be murdered that day, as Bush had a gun underneath the driver's seat of the car, and that it was Green who sexually assaulted him so violently that blood vessels within Bowman's face were broken. And Bowman stated that prior to and during this assault, Green informed him that Bush had, quote, killed a kid out in the woods by Chris's house. Bowman is one of those boys who is going to press charges against Bush and Green, stating in his original complaint that he had been forced to perform oral sex on both men on multiple occasions, and that Green had attempted to coerce him into going with him to a place called Playland, where Green wanted to attract other victims. There are others who are going to state that they were used as bait by both Bush and Green to snare other young boys. Somewhere between July 25th and July 31st, 1976, Bush has a second encounter with Kenneth Bowman, this one behind a high school where he forces the 13-year-old to perform oral sex on him. We know that Green purchases a van that summer, a brown and gold 1974 Chevy van. Later in statements given to investigators, Kenneth Bowman informs the officers that Green drove multiple vehicles during this period of time, not just this gold van, but also a 68 Impala and a blue and white Chevy Nova. According to the author of a timeline, which I am using as one of the many resources in this case, on or about October 7th, 1976, Gregory Green was at the Oakland University College campus, where Green encounters this individual who is aged 5 on the west wing of Vanderburg Hall, and that Green attempted to kidnap this individual and was unsuccessful. This individual postulates that there's a very good chance, given Green's various associates within the pedophile underworld, that Green had an associate who worked at the college who may have given Green access to the campus on this day, as well as on other occasions, which is very possible, as we don't have a definitive timeline of any of these men's movements. Now, while all of this is going on, police are getting tips stating that both Green and Bush may individually be responsible for the Oakland County child killings, but also stating that they may be working in tandem on these crimes. Some of these tips were lost, although we do have records that indicate that the tips were at least filed at one point. And the police are eventually going to take these tips seriously enough that they are going to question both men. An interesting side note concerns Christopher Bush. Victims of his have stated in both police reports as well as in interviews in the years since all of this happened that Bush's family was very protective of both their name and reputation as well as keeping Christopher out of trouble, and that on more than one occasion, Christopher's mother arrived at the home of a victim in a limousine and attempted to offer the victim and their family money to not go to the police or the press with the things that Christopher was being accused of. There's a very high probability of this. I don't see the Bush family going to such great lengths in terms of protecting Gregory Green, but their own flesh and blood, their son, whose arrest and convictions could bring consequences socially for the family, it is very possible and probable that this happened on a number of occasions. We've seen this kind of stuff often in the past, particularly with celebrities that have been accused of this type of behavior, such as Michael Jackson, who is said in court documents to have paid off victims that he had molested to ensure their silence. Whether or not Jackson actually committed any of these crimes is up to the individual listener, but we do know that some of those who made accusations against him did receive large cash settlements from Jackson. So this type of stuff does happen. It happens quite often, especially with wealthy individuals who are into the exploitation and abuse of children. And while you may be wondering how Bush could have done all of this under his family's nose, we do have records that indicate that the majority of his offenses occurred during periods that his parents were out of the country, which appears to have been quite often, given Christopher Bush's father's position with GM. He very often traveled to Europe as the head of the financial department, and as such, when he would travel, H. Lee Bush would take his wife with him, leaving Christopher in the home alone to do as he pleased. Bush and Green continue with their various offenses undetected until January 19th, 1977, when the principal of the Donovan North Middle School in Flint, Michigan, notices a man behaving strangely, attempting to talk to numerous boys. This principal ends up contacting the police. Now, unbeknownst to Gregory Green, during this period of time, some of his victims have confided in their families what has happened. And as a consequence of this, these families then go to the police, which leads to Gregory Green being arrested on January 25th, 1977, for the sexual assault of Kenneth Bowman. And during his interrogation, at least according to some sources, Gregory Green tells the police that Christopher Bush murdered Mark Stebbins. And the police take this seriously enough that they begin to look into Christopher Bush, as Gregory Green is denied bond and held in jail. Now, the following day, police make contact with Christopher Bush, and Bush is unaware that Green has rolled on him. He tells the officers that he was only a passing acquaintance of Gregory Green, and that he had never invited Green up to the family cabin or to any of the family properties, as Green was, quote-unquote, too violent. This same day, investigators, acting on information that Gregory Green has given them, stating that there were directions to the S. Lake cabin of the Bush family inside of his van, search the brown and gold van of Gregory Green, looking for said directions. And in the course of this search, they discover Polaroid pictures of two of the child victims of Gregory Green pressed against him, although it does not state what exactly that means. We can only assume that these are images depicting Green in the course of his sexual assault. Given that this is the mid-1970s, and these are Polaroid pictures, it stands to reason that someone else was involved inside of these assaults. It also states in the police report that two pairs of quote-unquote child's panties were found in Green's van, although it does not state whether or not these panties belonged to a male or a female victim. We have to assume, however, that given Green's previous history, this was more likely than not boys' underwear that was found in Gregory Green's van. This next bit of information is kind of cloudy. Some sources state that Bush ends up being arrested on the 26th while he's working at the restaurant that he manages. Others that he is arrested the following day, the 27th of January, at the same restaurant. Regardless, Bush is arrested for sexually assaulting Kenneth Bowman, the same charges that are brought against Gregory Green. We do know that on the 28th of January, Christopher Bush is given a polygraph, and at the time the police stated that Bush passed this polygraph, in effect clearing him of any involvement in the OCCK crimes. However, it has since come out in recent years as other individuals who are certified in polygraphs have looked at these results that Bush, in fact, failed his polygraph. Now, you know my thoughts on polygraphs, that they are bunk science, they are unreliable. I have to dismiss any information involving a polygraph because of that, because you can get a false positive, you can also get a false negative from these machines, as they are in no way, shape, or form indicative of a suspect's guilt in a crime, be that the commission of the crime or of knowledge in this crime. It is interesting to note, however, that during his interrogation by officers, during which Christopher Bush denied any involvement in Mark Stebbins' abduction and murder, he was asked about other activities he was involved in, and according to a report by Southfield Detective Lorne Doan, Bush said he picked up a young boy at Nine Mile and Woodward in Ferndale, and that he dropped him off in Royal Oak near 13 Mile Road and Woodland Avenue. He said he also had a little brother in the Big Brother program that he often took to Hartfield's Bowling Alley and also to the 7-Eleven store. Why are these areas important? Well, the first area that Bush gives is the abduction site of Mark Stebbins, the area where he drops this supposed victim off is the Jill Robinson abduction site. The bowling alley is where Christine Milich's mother worked, and the 7-Eleven that he mentions is the area where Christine was in fact abducted from. Officers believe that Bush did not give these locations as an admission of guilt, but rather to establish that he frequented these areas, thus explaining away anyone who may have said that they saw him in these areas during a period of time when one of the first three victims disappeared. He also reveals that both he and Green shared a similar fantasy of abducting and holding a child, and that they would split their time with this child, with one of them going to their day job and the other having access to the child, and then the one who is working coming back and having access to the child while the other one went out and went to their job. This meaning that someone was always with the victim in this fantasy. Now, back to the polygraph briefly. It's been noted that the Oakland County Deputy Prosecutor Dick Thompson traveled more than 40 miles in order to observe Christopher Bush's polygraph, something that has been noted as having never occurred prior to or since in any polygraph examination in Detroit. On this very same date, January 28, 1977, officers obtain a search warrant for the Bush family home, located in Alma at 736 North State Street, Alma, Michigan. During this search, detectives found two shotguns, half to one full pound of marijuana, one suitcase containing miscellaneous ropes and ligatures, and one suitcase containing child porn's books, magazines, and films. It's interesting to note that all of this stuff is going to be confiscated and would later mysteriously disappear. So the court sets Christopher Bush's bond at $75,000. This is later reduced to $1,000, although we have no indication anywhere as to why this happened. More likely than not, it was due to his father's political influence. We do know that on January 31st of 1977, Christopher Bush, his father, pays for his son's bond in cash, and Christopher Bush is released. The next day, February 1st, Gregory Green is given a polygraph, which it's said that he passes. However, in reviews conducted by independent sources in 2008, it was found that Gregory Green completely failed his polygraph. So you have one suspect who completely fails his polygraph, another who is said to have failed his polygraph, or that the results were inclusive. Again, though, I have to discount the polygraphs because they are not an exact science. They are highly fallible, and as any lawyer will tell you, they are not admissible in court due to this reason. However, it is interesting to note that on the date that Green is given his polygraph, he was asked about the child killings and stated that the person responsible either knew the child and wanted to keep them quiet, or it was a one-time encounter. He also stated when asked about what should happen to the individual responsible for these crimes, that it depended on the person. Gregory Green is going to end up receiving a life sentence for his involvement in the sexual assaults perpetrated against Kenneth Bowman. However, the records of his time incarcerated from January of 1977 up until his trial are kind of hazy. Official records state that he was incarcerated for 144 days consecutively up until the start of his trial date, while notes in the task force files state that he was actually out on bond for periods of time before his trial started and was in fact out on bond during the period of time that Timothy King was abducted and murdered. Again, though, we don't have any way to verify which of these two statements is true. And it's left to speculation as to whether or not Gregory Green was involved in Timothy King's abduction and murder. This is further clouded by the fact that a witness came forward in December of 2020 stating that Gregory Green had been seen at a drugstore in Berkeley at some point after March 18th or 19th, 1977. This is important as you'll recall that Timothy King was abducted on the 16th. So if Green is seen at this drugstore during this period of time and he ends up really matching the composite sketches that are released of the suspected abductor, then it is extremely possible that Gregory Green was in fact involved in Timothy King's abduction and murder. However, though, that is just speculation because, again, we have documents stating that Green was definitely in jail during that period of time, which leads us to the idea that this person who came forward in December of 2020 is either having a case of mistaken identity or it is wishful thinking on their part that this individual that they saw during this period of time was Gregory Green when it was in fact someone else. We're going to end the episode at this point. We're going to pick it up the same spot next week. We're going to continue to further discuss Gregory Green and Christopher Bush and possibly get into discussing North Fox Island. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid!